What will be the impact of Ukraine now launching long-range weapons deeper into Russia? Why is NATO, a renowned collective security arrangement, referred to as a gang of thugs? Will the Ukraine war truly escalate to a full-blown nuclear war? Why are activists mobilizing this weekend to oppose Canadian participation in NATO? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with tensions soaring lately over the decision by outgoing President Biden to allow Ukraine to fire ATACMS missiles into the territory of its neighbors, we are spending time discussing the latest stage of the conflict, which could make NATO a direct combatant in the Russia-Ukraine war and lead to World War III. For most of the show, we are joined by military veteran-turned-peace activist Scott Ritter to tell us about some of the history of the war extending way before February 2022, the latest updates, and his involvement with Operation Dawn. Toward the end of the show, we hear from Hamilton-based peace activist Ken Stone about plans to counter NATO during the group's meeting in Montreal, Quebec, this coming weekend. On this week's program, has Biden's decision forced NATO into World War III? Conversations with Scott Ritter and Ken Stone. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 22, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Settlers seized the land through faulty promises, broken treaties, and force, relegating the Indigenous people to generations of colonialism and genocide. We strive to acknowledge these crimes and achieve a new and respectful relationship between both populations moving forward. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Introduction. In this follow-up interview, Peter and we discuss the fact that despite a leadership change with the Trump presidency, the technocratic transhumanist agenda continues. He gives updates on the fact that the geopolitical situation is not what it seems, and that there is more collaboration of world powers than meets the eye to continue digital money, digital enslavement, and the rise of AI. We also discuss the spiritual warfare and the escape from this matrix through knowledge of self and our quantum holographic universe. Anna Maria Mihalci, MD. That's from the introduction to the video under the headline Transhumanist Technocracy Continues, Truth, Science, and Spirit by Peter Koenig and Dr. Anna Maria Mihalci, posted November 20th, originally broadcast on the series Truth, Science, and Spirit. More generally, it looks at the intertwining of political centralization and corporate consolidation that is undermining democratic processes, economic diversity, and local autonomy. This unholy alliance is creating a self-reinforcing technocratic dystopia that concentrates power in the hands of a super wealthy elite, which increasingly depicts anyone who challenges it as the, quote, enemy within, unquote. In this respect, the book weds the topic of food to the wider dynamics of power in society, which is becoming increasingly concentrated, resulting in the domination of both resources and populations, and seeking to shape the very fabric of our lives and beliefs about who we are and what we could or should be. Such an analysis is integral to gaining a deeper understanding of the food system and the influence of global agribusiness and the tech giants that are increasingly moving into the food and agriculture sector. The following discussion is driven by a conviction in the transformative power of relocalizing food systems, revitalizing traditional ecological wisdom, and rekindling our connection to the land that nourishes us. That comes from the intro to a new book under the headline Power Play, The Future of Food by Colin Todd Hunter, posted November 21st. This quote-unquote controversial political party, Alternative for Germany, hence the AfD acronym, is now the second most popular in the country and is essential for making any potential coalitions, much to the chagrin of the ruling elite. In fact, they're so terrified of this prospect that they're mulling a total blanket ban on the AfD, which would be an entirely unprecedented move. According to reports from German state media, specifically the ARD and ZDF, the motion to ban the AfD was signed by 112 MPs, that's members of parliament, and has also been handed to Bundestag President Bärbel Bas of the far-left Social Democrats, or SPD. If the ban were to pass, the Bundestag, German parliament, will start additional proceedings that will also include the Constitutional Court of Germany, which will then determine whether the AfD can be legally banned. It should be noted that there are 733 seats in the Bundestag, and the motion just needs a simple majority to be adopted. That comes from the article. Germany's, quote, political collapse, unquote. Scholz government mulls banning its second largest party, AfD, ahead of snap elections, by Drago Bosnick, posted November 20th. Originally published on InfoBricks. On October 20th, 2023, we managed a live WhatsApp call with Dr. Ahmed Muhanna, director of Al-Ada Hospital in northern Gaza. Despite poor sound and video quality, the communication worked. You can watch our conversation on the second video of this article. 2 months later, on 17th of December 2023, Dr. Muhanna was abducted by Israeli occupation forces. Since then, there has been no information about his fate, health, or whereabouts. Several other medical colleagues have also been abducted, some of whom died under suspicious circumstances after severe torture, while others were tortured and later released. That comes from the article, Dr. Abed from Al-Ada Hospital in Gaza, quote, "We will continue to save what remains of our people," unquote, by Dr. Fayez Abed and Lode Vanoust, posted November 20th.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
As of this date, we commemorate 1,000 days since the war in Ukraine began in February of 2024. Russia formed a partnership with North Korea, and apparently there are North Korean soldiers on the battlefield. Ukraine asked for permission to fire long-range 300 kilometers or more weapons into Russia. And I guess the first time they did this in September 2024, the U.S. almost gave them permission, but then they changed their minds. Now, after Trump was elected, he reversed his decision. And just this morning, November 19th, Ukraine fired six ATACMS missiles into Russia. The Russians destroyed five of them. The other,
sort of fell apart. But Putin has now authorized a new nuclear policy using nuclear deterrence against hostile powers and military blocs. We'll get an analysis on these late-breaking events and where they're leading with a favorite guest of mine. His name is Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter is a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer. He served in the Soviet Union as an inspector in implementing the INF Treaty in General Schwarzkopf's staff during the Gulf War, and from 1991 to 1998 as a UN weapons inspector. He's become more of a peace activist in recent years, and he's been active during the last election campaigning against nuclear war. Also, he's a commentator on this and other independent media outlets. Scott, it's great to have you join us again. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So, with regard to the Ukraine's attacks just this morning, will the use of ATACMS missiles and other long-range weaponry actually give Ukraine any strategic advantage against Russia?
Yeah, I'll answer that in the question. I just want to set the record straight. This isn't the 1,000th day of the war. This war is something that, if you want to get technical, began in February of 2014 with the CIA-backed coup d'etat against the constitutionally elected government of Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine, replacing him with hand-picked, acolytes of the United States. Victoria Nuland's infamous phone call with the American ambassador to Ukraine underscores the reality of my statement. They empowered a Ukrainian nationalist government that immediately declared war against the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine, leading to conflict in Crimea that precipitated the Russians annexing Crimea, primarily Russian populated region, and leading to conflict in the Donbas that led to this new Ukrainian government declaring the Russian citizens there, the Russian speaking citizens, to be terrorists, and they called it an anti-terrorist organization, leading to conflict that killed thousands of innocent civilians, leading to a military revolt backed by Russia that almost achieved the strategic defeat of Ukraine. The Ukrainian army was surrounded by this pro-Russian group in late 2014, early 2015. And Ukraine, together with France and Germany, intervened and asked the Russians to show mercy, asked Putin not to kill the Ukrainian military, but to agree to a ceasefire, the Minsk Accords. Putin agreed, released the Ukrainian military, and began a process of trying to negotiate a peaceful outcome to this conflict. What we now know is that neither the Ukrainians, the French, or the British, or the Germans were serious about this. Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine at the time, admits that they were just buying time for NATO to rebuild a Ukrainian army so they could continue the offensive against the Russian-speaking population of the Donbas and potentially Crimea. François Hollande, the French president, concurs on this, as did Angela Merkel, that it was a sham, that the peace offer was a sham designed to buy time for NATO to build a Ukrainian army. And NATO is actively doing this in a training base in Western Ukraine starting in 2015. The United States was training a battalion of Ukrainian forces every 55 days to, according to documents prepared by the United States, be trained in the West to go east to fight the Russians and kill Russians in eastern Ukraine. This was the goal of the United States. So the notion that this war began in February of 2022 is an absurdity extreme. Russia had no choice but to carry out what it calls legitimate preemptive self-defense under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. And this defines the legal construct of this conflict. And this is important that we have the facts down, because to allow the narrative painted by the Ukrainians and the West to proceed unchallenged then creates the conditions to where I need to correct you again. There is no evidence that North Korea has troops in Russia today. There is no evidence that North Korea has troops in Russia today. And if you want to believe that North Korea has deployed combat troops to Russia, then you have to say that neither Russia nor North Korea are serious about the rule of law. Why do I say that? Because in order to have North Korean troops in Russia fighting on behalf of Russia, you need a treaty. No such treaty existed. In fact, the Russians and the North Koreans just recently ratified the treaty that could allow this to happen and create the conditions, but they ratified this treaty long after the West started talking about North Korean troops being present in the Kursk region. It's a manufactured narrative with no substance. And yet, Ukraine has used this as an excuse, and the United States has used this as an excuse to ask for and give permission to fire ATACMS missiles into Kursk to respond to this North Korean mobilization that is non-existent. No evidence exists whatsoever to sustain the notion that North Korea has deployed combat troops to Kursk and that those troops are engaged in fights against the Ukrainians. It's Ukrainian propaganda that was designed to empower this decision. Now, this decision to send ATACMS missiles, and understand this, the ATACMS missile has been used by Ukraine against Russians for some time now, for well over a year. The ATACMS missile, maybe not a year, maybe since June. I have to go back. I think June might have been when they first started using it. But the ATACMS missile was used against Russian forces in the territories of dispute: Kherson, Zaporizhia, Lugansk, Donetsk, and Crimea. And Russia has not said that this is a cause for nuclear war. They condemned its use, but they recognize that this is, in the area of dispute. What's changed here is that Ukraine is now using these weapons against undisputed Russian territory. They fired against the a region around Bryansk, the city of Bryansk. This isn't just Ukraine firing missiles, though. As Vladimir Putin himself has said on September 12th, in order for these missiles to be fired, the United States has to do the targeting. The United States alone is empowered to create the data necessary to guide the missile using its terrain following radars guidance system and to enable Ukraine to communicate on the encrypted military GPS channels. These aren't open communications. They are use encryption, American encryption, which requires American hands to load the encrypted key onto the missile so that it can communicate using American satellites with American GPS systems. The bottom line is these weapons cannot be fired unless American hands are all over these weapons, directing where these weapons go. So when Ukraine fired six ATACMS missiles towards Bryansk, it was the United States firing six ATACMS missiles toward Bryansk. The United States attacked Russia. That's the reality. That's the reality that Vladimir Putin articulated on September 12th when he said this exact same thing. And that's now the reality that manifested itself this morning when the United States ordered six attack missiles to be fired against Russia. The United States has declared war on Russia. Again, not me saying this. This is the statement of the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, who on September 13th, when warning the United States about giving Ukraine the authority to use these missiles against Russia, said it would be an act of war, a declaration of war. Well, war has been declared by the United States on Russia. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. It's not the weapon that changes the game, it's the political intent behind the use of the weapon. The United States saying, we don't care that Russia views this as an act of war because we believe that Russia is bluffing, that Russia will not do anything. And then this sets in step what the next step will be. The French have said they're going to give permission for the Ukrainians to use the Scalp cruise missile. The British have said they're giving Ukraine permission to use the Storm Shadow. The United States was the lead agency. We're the ones who said this is happening. We tested the waters. Russia so far has done nothing. Now we'll get more attacks. If Russia does nothing, then we'll supply Ukraine with either a longer range system. And if Russia continues to do nothing, then Poland will extend its air defense umbrella into Western Ukraine to engage Russian missiles on behalf of Ukraine. And then if the US does nothing, NATO aircraft will operate over Ukrainian soil to shoot down these missiles as the United States has done in support of Israel. And then the United States and NATO will put thousands of boots on the ground so that when Donald Trump becomes president on January 20th, he will be faced with a fait accompli that Ukraine will be a de facto member of NATO. This all again is predicated on Russia doing nothing. But Russia has said that it will treat this as an attack, that the response will be decisive. And indeed, today, the Russians have come out and said that we have entered a qualitatively new phase of the conflict, reflective of the reality that the United States just attacked to attack Russia. What this means, we don't know. Russia has signed off on a new nuclear doctrine, which literally allows Russia to use nuclear weapons in response to attack of this nature. Whether Russia will use nuclear weapons or will use, according to a Russian senator who spoke on this issue, who's a member of the Defense Committee, use new non-nuclear weapons of n unprecedented power. There needs to be a Russian response, because if there's not, we're going to see NATO double down and continue to do provocative actions. And the other thing I think you said, at least the way I heard it, is that Donald Trump has made this decision. Donald Trump is not the president. Donald Trump won an election on November 5th, but he won't be the president until January 20th. Everything that's happening today is because of the Biden administration, because of Joe Biden and his advisors.
Whether it's Zelensky or the US behind the scenes, their whole goal is essentially to get NATO involved, and then Trump he carries it out. Because I'm saying it's not going to accomplish anything other than get that sort of the World War III in motion, as I see it.
Well, it's not that Trump will complete the mission. Trump wants to end the war in Ukraine and prevent a nuclear war with Russia, which means he wants to normalize relations with Russia. Trump also has articulated that he would not object to the U.S. pulling out of NATO. He views NATO as a problem, not a solution. NATO is in a panic right now because the theory of a Trump presidency in 2 months becomes the reality of a Trump presidency and the end of NATO as we know it. So they are desperate to change the geopolitical calculus, so to speak. And that's what's at play here. They're trying to make it impossible for Trump to bring an end to this conflict. They're trying to make NATO part of Ukraine so that it makes it impossible for Russia to accept negotiations. They want Trump to support NATO, to confront Russia, to bring relevance to NATO. This is their goal and their objective. What Trump will do is unknown. I don't think Trump, because he ran on a platform of avoiding war with Russia. Indeed, he had two members of his inner circle, Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump Jr., his son, write and publish an article in The Hill where they said it is the goal. Their goal is to bring an end to the conflict in Ukraine, to prevent a nuclear war with Russia, and to normalize relations with Russia, restore relations with Russia. That still is their goal. The Biden administration is trying to make it impossible for Trump to do that, to be disruptive of the Trump policy in regards to both NATO and Ukraine, and then see if NATO can drag this out for 4 years, until which time the Democratic Party hopes to be able to launch a counterattack at the polls and remove Donald Trump as the president of the United States, or remove his designated replacement, in this case probably J.D. Vance, who likewise has articulated very aggressively against supporting Ukraine and against NATO. So the idea here is to complicate Trump's ability to act on the platform that he ran in this election, the platform that he was elected to implement. Joe Biden is attempting to undermine that by carrying out actions that are decisively against the will of the American people. The American people did not vote for continuation of the conflict for potential nuclear war with Russia. They voted for the exact opposite. That's why Donald Trump won. But what we're seeing here is a total disregard for American democracy by the Biden administration, which brings into play some of the things that Trump has talked about. The deep state. What can sustain this? The unelected mass of civil servants that populate the various departments and agencies that constitute the United States government. These people are the ones who would be continuing to advocate in favor of NATO, in favor of current policies. But they need ammunition, and that's what Biden's doing right now, is giving them the ammunition of a fait accompli, of a de facto result that then the establishment will fight for, defend for, push for, advocate for, regardless of the fact that that's not what the Trump administration wants. And so, then Trump would be forced to, go to war against the establishment on this issue, which is not necessarily the issues he wants to, and it complicates what he's trying to accomplish here. So I think Biden is basically trying to create chaos, a chaotic world for the Trump presidency when they come into office on January 20th.
Your book was called Covering Ukraine, Scott Ritter Through the Eyes of Anya Kay, because it's basically a series of transcribed interviews. You defined it as a gang. I wonder if you could just briefly explain this new definition of what makes NATO basically a gang of thugs, despite professed the need to sometimes work with others for security purposes.
Sure. Well, first of all, I have to give credit to this to my my collaborator Anya Kay. That's her podcast, the Through the Eyes of Anya Kay. And this book, as you rightly said, is drawn from interviews that Anya Kay did with me over the course of 2 years covering the issue of Ukraine. And it's only 120 pages, but you know, if it covers in comprehensive way the entire spectrum of issues that comprise the Ukraine conflict. And if anybody is sitting there saying, well, I need to get up to speed, here it is, one book, 120 pages. You can read it in a day, reread it during the day, and it will answer almost every question you have. But Anya Kay had brought up a question related to NATO and its 14 articles, and she focused on Article 1, which basically said that you know, they're going to comply with the Charter of the United Nations to settle international disputes by peaceful means, et cetera. And then it's clear that NATO doesn't operate by Article 1. And so, you know, she said, so in the case of if Article 1 is clearly not respected, who is looking over it? Who is the judge to say, all right, NATO, you're not respecting Article 1. Is it the United Nations? And I said, no, NATO is not beholden to the United Nations. NATO is a collective security arrangement, a treaty that operates outside the framework of the United Nations. So the Secretary General of the UN has no impact on it. NATO is beholden to no one but its collective membership, so they please themselves. And Anya Kay said, so it's like a gang. And I agreed. That's the perfect definition. NATO is a gang, a lawless gang of thugs who operate outside of the rule of the law, and they have just decided that they're going to control this street corner called Europe and expand it. They're like any gang, they're looking to expand their turf. So they expanded it into parts of Europe that weren't compliant. Serbia, a war of aggression against a fellow European state that involved, I mean, I love to hear it, not love, but it just frustrates me. But you know, to hear NATO members say, the Russian bombardment of European of Ukrainian cities is the first time since the end of the Second World War that a European nation has bombed another European nation. Well, they tend to forget that NATO bombed Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, in 1999, inflicting horrific damage and casualties. NATO it was engaged in an offensive war of aggression against Libya in 2011 that led to regime change and the destruction of a nation state that was thriving. And now look at it, it's destitute. NATO participated in the illegal occupation and attempt to install a Western-oriented government in Afghanistan, a failed experiment that led to the embarrassing retreat of NATO in the United States in 2021. And now NATO is involved in this ongoing effort to convert Ukraine into a weapon against Russia. NATO is at war with Russia. The only reason why NATO exists today is to confront Russia, a Russia that was threatening nobody. It wasn't Russia that expanded to NATO's borders. It was NATO that expanded to Russia's borders after promising with the dissolution of the Soviet Union that NATO would not expand 1 inch eastward. It was a lie, like everything NATO stand for. It's a lie. It's a gang of thugs. And that's why I think the Trump administration is, you know, will move to ban this gang, to outlaw this gang. Because if you're seeking to restore, you know, order and the rule of law, you have to get rid of those who operate outside the framework of the rule of law. NATO is definitely that.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Involved with something called Operation Dawn, which was essentially about getting the US to scale down from the brink of nuclear war. I followed it online, and you had a big event in September, late September. You were trying to get peace and nuclear war as the issue in the US election. Do you think that you succeeded now that Trump and the Republicans are returning to Washington in January? And What happens next? What's your Operation Dawn 2.0?
Well, Operation Dawn, basically the term Dawn is derived from four questions that I put forward to the American people. What would you do to save democracy, to save America, to save the world through your vote in November? And I wanted them to empower their vote by saying, we're not giving our vote to anybody. You have to earn our vote. And the issue that we want you to earn our vote on is the issue of preventing a nuclear war. The event took place on September 28th, and the presentation I gave was linked to the events of September 13th and 14th here in the United States. I reminded everybody that we almost all died because had Joe Biden signed off on the documents authorizing Ukraine to use U.S. ATACMS missiles, British Storm Shadow, and French Scout missiles against targets inside Russia, Russia at that time had said straight up that there will be a nuclear response. And so I said, look, this is existential. There's a lot of issues out there. There's Gaza, there's the economy, there's the ecology, there's global warming, there's racism, there's abortion, there's gun. There's a million issues, but none of them matter if we're all dead. And only one of these issues is going to result in a war that's going to kill us all. And that's the conflict in Ukraine. And so I wanted people to focus on this. We did other things. We had a in October, we had an event in New York City where we ran three panels, one dedicated to the issue of a nuclear war, the other free speech. Again, one of the it's a related issue because I've been raided by the FBI for having the audacity to speak out against the policies of the Biden administration. I've been accused
Yes.
of being a Russian agent, which is absurd in the extreme. That my crime, free speech and executing free speech, a free press and publishing that which I want to publish. But if the FBI and the Department of Justice have their way, they will silence all dissenting voices. And so it will be impossible to have a program like Operation Dawn because Operation Dawn is premised on free speech, the ability to speak freely, to publish your words in a free press, to have Americans, associate freely. The FBI and the Department of Justice, the Biden administration views Operation Dawn as a direct threat to their continued hold on power. But we had this panel in New York City. We talked about nuclear war. We talked about free speech, and we talked about saving democracy, the importance of vote empowerment. It's very difficult. We're not a major party. We're not affiliated with a party. We're sort of a grassroots movement that is, trying its best to get its voice heard. One of the things when I launched Operation Dawn is I talked about what I called the family of podcasts, that is, alternative media outlets that support one another. I appear on a whole bunch of different platforms. This I appear on Judge Napolitano's Judging Freedom. Dialogue Works, Nima Rostami's platform. Garland Nixon has an outstanding podcast. Danny Haifong has one. Wilmer Leon has one. Russell Dobular, Jimmy Dore, and all of these together, you're looking at these platforms attracting between 200 and 500,000 viewers per per event in a week's time. Operation Dawn, using the family of podcasts, is getting its message out to millions of people per week. That means that we have had the since September 28th, between September 28th and November 5th, we had our message heard by tens of millions of Americans. This is very big. It's a success beyond belief. But it's not just that we had our voices heard. The message was heard by one campaign, the Trump campaign. And Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump Jr. reacting to a message that was derived from Operation Dawn wrote an opinion piece that was published in The Hill on in September, which committed to a policy of ending the conflict in Ukraine and preventing nuclear war. And this op-ed was supported by the president-elect himself. And so today we have a president-elect who has committed to policies of preventing nuclear war that were promoted by and pushed on them by Operation Dawn. Operation Dawn is a freaking huge success. It's a massive success. We have had national level impact, but now we have to complete the mission. You see, democracy doesn't work just by what you vote on election day. My theory is I voted for them. Now I get to hold them to account, not just get to, I must hold them to account. And that's what Operation Dawn 2.0 is. It's completing the mission, supervising the outcome, ensuring that a Trump administration stays true to the message that it ran on, that it said it wants to bring an end to this conflict in Ukraine, run on a policy of preventing nuclear war. And so we will hold them to account. And I will make holding the Trump administration to account one of my premier missions going forward, along with encouraging the Trump administration to speak out in defense of free speech, bring to an end this politicized investigation by the FBI, not only of me, but of many others, including the Uhura 3, a black nationalist movement out of St. Louis, Missouri, that is on trial in Florida, accused of free speech. We need to bring these to an end. And then we need the Trump administration. I say they saved a democracy because the will of the people was manifested on November 5th. The people voted for change, and now change is, has the potential of coming. But we need to make sure that this change takes place, or else the votes of tens of millions of Americans are meaningless. But that's what Operation 2.0 is. It's the defense of democracy by holding elected representatives accountable for what they promised to do and what they are doing in our name.
Hey, Scott Ritter, I think that there's another cash question. I mean, just to emphasize the seriousness of the situation. I mean, there are people who would say, well, it looks like, there's this war is going to continue. I can't do anything about it. And Operation Dawn can't do anything about it. Maybe I should just go off to North New Zealand or something like that, because it's in the Southern Hemisphere. All these war making powers are in the North, United States, NATO, Russia, and so on. So, I mean, what do you, in terms of what you know about military systems and military, and the nuclear situation, I mean, what would you say to such individuals who play that kind of, save my own neck scenario?
Well, I would say two things. One, if there's a nuclear war, you can't run away from it. Everybody will die. That's just the reality. The way things work, there will be, if we have a large scale nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia, billions of people will be killed, hundreds of millions immediately, billions later, there will be global ice age, and the radioactive fallout will circle the world, bringing on nuclear winter, and you will all either starve to death, die of radiation poisoning, or, disease, et cetera. You can't outrun this. Good luck. If you think you can find a place in the world that will survive, go read Neville Shute's book On the Beach, 1957 book made into a movie in 1959. It talks about the notion that Australia was surviving because there was a nuclear war, but they didn't get hit. But now the radiation is coming down their way and it kills everybody. And that's what will happen. You will die. There's no chance of surviving. You can't run away from it. But also running away is the coward's way out. I know there's people out there who said, well, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. Well, welcome to a democracy. You lost. Donald Trump won, and he won not by stealing an election. He won by winning more votes. And the people who voted for him were voting for change. We're talking about revolutionary change. Now, you can be opposed to that, but when you lose an election, rather than running away, that means you don't believe in America. You don't believe in democracy. You're a quitter. If you think Donald Trump shouldn't have won, then stay here and fight. Stay here and fight. Come up with a better candidate. Be able to articulate what you believe in better. Win more votes than Donald Trump. But right now, understand this. We have a president who ran on a platform that said he wanted to end the war in Ukraine and prevent the possibility of nuclear war with Russia. How can you be against that? I guess you can say you're against it if you're somebody who believes that Ukraine is a sovereign democratic state and Russia invaded it, but I would say that your facts are wrong. And even if you believe in that, is defending Ukraine worth the existential survival of the United States? And the answer is no. America doesn't depend on Ukraine for our survival. Therefore, why should we commit suicide over the issue of Ukraine? But democracy is ugly. Democracy is not efficient, and democracy only works if The people believe that they can manifest the changes that they desire through their vote. And for the first time in a long time, the people were given a change that didn't involve a duopoly where the Democrats and Republicans run on different names, but the outcome's always the same. There is no change, whether you want to call it the blob, the deep state, the establishment, whatever you want to call it. There's this mass of unelected civil servants who govern America regardless of who the Democrats, or if it's a Democrat or a Republican. There's never been change, no meaningful change. That's over. The American people voted for change. The American people said, we want to bring an end to this establishment. And they empowered a man, Donald Trump, to come in and make radical changes. This is democracy in action. Whether you support it, the outcome or not, you have to concede that the will of the American people for change is being manifested. That is what democracy is about. If you oppose this, stay here and fight. Say, no, we're going to, you know, oppose you, will be the opposition. And in 4 years, we're going to run against you and seek to bring an end to this. If you support this, stay here and fight so that the changes you demanded through your vote are actually implemented. This is what democracy is about. Those people who run, they've lost faith in democracy, or they never believed in democracy to begin with.
Well, I got about 1 minute left. I just wanted to see if you could say something about the unicorn video that you played, because I think it kind of aligns with that whole idea of change. Just explain it briefly for us.
Sure. Well, first of all, you can find it's a song called Daydreams that my daughter wrote this music back when she was in eighth grade. It was part of a fantasy world that she created because she was concerned about nuclear war and climate change. And so she and her twin sister created this fantasy world called Annamara that had the survivors of a global disaster, you know, go space travel to a new world where they could start all over again. And so they had this fantasy world, this escapism. She wrote this beautiful song called Theme to Annamara. Annamara was the name of that world. And that song has been in my mind forever. And I was sitting here saying, you know, how do I convince people that, you know, this isn't just, you know, a throwaway cause, that I truly believe in this? And how do I send that message? And I said, why don't we turn this beautiful tune that she did into a song, into a music video? And so we conspired with Malcolm Burns, award-winning, he's Canadian, a Canadian-American, lives in Kingston. He had a studio, a home studio. He's produced, you know, Emily Lou Harris. He's produced Bob Dylan. He's produced everybody. And he produced my daughter. She came down and he played this song. And then he convinced her to sing the soundtrack. I wrote the lyrics. He put in a little bass guitar. He put in a little strings and some piano that was artfully put in at the appropriate time. He listened to me when I said, I want to capture the spirit of childhood in this, and childhood betrayed, what it means to be a child and believe in something only to have your world go insane, and what the consequences of nuclear war would be on a child and child dreams. And then we brought this music, and my other daughter, Victoria, and her fiance, Sam, they, you know, when they grew up, they drew these drawings about this world, Annamara, these very detailed drawings. And I said, we need to recapture this. We need you to provide illustrations that aren't that of an adult, but of a child. Go back in time and recreate this world. And I directed it based upon the song. And they did these fantastic watercolor drawings that we then use to serve as the illustrations for this song, Daydreams. And it's available. Go to scottritter.com. You can go there. You can view it. It's for free. You can download the music if you want to on your MP3 player. But I played this. I debuted this at the Kingston event, where Operation Dawn kicked off as a way of saying, you know, this is what's at stake here. This is my family. This is a product produced by my daughters. This is beautiful. This is wonderful. And it's all going to end if there's a nuclear war. And this song is the manifestation of this cause, why it's important to believe in children. As they sing at the end, I don't believe in uniforms. I believe in unicorns.
Okay. Well, Scott, on that note, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a tremendous It's a real honor to have you on the show again, and we look forward to hearing more from you maybe sometime in the near future.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back. And yes, let's stay in touch.
Okay, thanks. Scott Ritter is a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer, a former UN weapons inspector, and a frequent commentator. Ken Stone, as you know, is the treasurer of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. He also works with the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, and he's helping to organize a major action in Montreal in response to the 70th annual Parliamentary Assembly of NATO. He joins us now to talk a little bit more about it. Ken, it's great to have you back, and welcome to the Global Research NewsHour.
It's always a pleasure, Michael.
Can you remind our listeners about the principal concerns you have right now, what you and your group have with NATO right now?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that on their website, NATO says that the NATO Parliamentary Assembly was established in 1955 to engage parliamentarians in transatlantic issues and help build parliamentary and public consensus in support of alliance policies. So basically, what's happening in Montreal this coming weekend from November 22nd to 25th is a PR exercise, a huge, costly PR exercise in which they're bringing about 400 or 500 parliamentarians and their assistants to Montreal from 32 countries, plus delegations from strategic allies. One of those strategic allies of NATO is the State of Israel, which is now conducting a genocide against the people of Palestine and is waging a war against the people of Lebanon. And so our Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network has decided to hold a counter summit to NATO's Parliamentary Assembly in Montreal this Sunday, and also to support a demonstration that's being held by the Mouvement Québécois pour la Paix on Saturday in Montreal at Place du Canada at 2 p.m. The purpose of both, the main slogan, if you will, of both events is hashtag Canada out of NATO. And so I encourage all your listeners to use that hashtag to find out more. And of course, people can go to the website of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, and there's a page there which has all the information about the counter summit on the Sunday, which is taking place at the Greek Workers Hall on Park Avenue in Montreal. And we will have many famous people there speaking from the peace movement around the world, including Medea Benjamin, and she's the co-founder of Code Pink in the US and an author. She just wrote a book about NATO. It's called NATO, What You Need to Know. And the other international speaker is Seven Dagdelem, who is of a new left-wing party in the German parliament called the Bundestag. And they are against NATO and they are against the war in Ukraine. So she has written a book as well. Both those sisters will be coming to us remotely because we don't have the money to fly them in and put them up. Unfortunately, at this point, the peace movement is still young and new, at least as far as the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network is concerned. But we are concerned, to answer your question, about NATO's bellicose policies concerning against Russia, China, and Iran. First of all, of course, the biggest issue is that NATO is gambling with our lives right now. As you probably know, NATO, Michael, has gotten the green light from U.S. President Biden to place in Ukraine long-range missile systems, which they can aim at Russia. Now, these long-range missile systems, which are the properties of the U.S., the U.K., and the French governments, are not run by the Ukrainians, because this is really proprietary material, and the Ukraine does not have satellites up in space, and it does not have AWACS planes flying around the Black Sea, but the US and France and England do. And what happens is that these long-range missiles are being targeted by NATO countries, the US, France, and Britain. And Russia has responded by saying that they regard the firing of these weapons by these countries, not Ukraine. The Ukrainian soldier comes in at the last second after all the planning, the targeting, and the computers technology has gone through, just to press the launch button. So Russia says these are acts of war, or these would be acts of war, by the Britain, France, and the U.S. against Russia, and they will retaliate. So what's happened is that that NATO has recklessly raised the escalation, climbed the escalation ladder to where we are within one or two steps of a nuclear confrontation between East and West. So that's one concern we have. The other concern, of course, is that that NATO, which regards Israel as its vital ally in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean, quote unquote, is openly arming and supplying the state of Israel while it is conducting what the International Court of Justice deems a plausible genocide in Gaza. So these are the big concerns. NATO is at the moment pushing the world to the brink of nuclear war in Europe and maybe in West Asia, because the state of Israel is looking to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran, which is backed in turn by Russia and China. So there's two theaters of war in which NATO could get us all killed. That's our concern.
The Prime Minister announced that Canada will increase its contributions to NATO to keep us in lockstep with NATO demands. Is this also a part of your resistance to NATO?
Absolutely, Michael. The countries of NATO agreed, I think it was in 2014, that they would have a 2% ceiling on their GDP, on their military expenditures for NATO, that they would move up to 2%. So in 2014, Canada was spending $20 billion on military arms at that time in Canada, for Canada. Since 2014 till today, Canada's military spending has increased by $20 billion. It's doubled in 10 years. So it's now $41 billion. And Mr. Trudeau's, and that's only 1.4% of GDP. Trudeau has announced that Canada will comply with NATO's 2% ceiling, which is now becoming a 2% floor, by 2032. So that means by 2032, Canada will be spending $82 billion on the military in Canada, buying mostly U.S. arms, which are required for NATO partners to have what they call interoperability of weapons. So that's why we're buying these frigates, or having these frigates built. That's why we're buying $77 billion worth of F-35 fighter jets. We now are spending $5 billion on a drone fleet. All these things are being purchased to match NATO's requirement for a 2% now floor on spending by member countries. And if you look at the kinds of weapons that are being purchased, these are not weapons that you would use to defend Canada against an aggressor. These are weapons that you would use if Canada were participating in a NATO military operation intervention somewhere in the world. You don't use F-35 jets to protect your country. You use F-35 jets to attack another country. You don't need frigates to defend Canada. You would need much smaller patrol boats and a lot more of them. Mm-hmm. So we are purchasing weapons so that we can continue our job as Canadians, according to the Canadian government, not the Canadian people, of being a junior partner in the U.S. empire, helping to expand U.S. domination or hold on to U.S. domination, in the parts of the world where it still is dominant.
Yeah.
Those $82 billion that we're going to be spending by 2032 means that that's $82 billion that's not going for housing. It's not going to help the homeless. It's going for fighter jets and not water bombers to protect the forest. It's not going to health care. It's not going to reconciliation with the native peoples. And it's not going to environmental mitigation. So this is money that's just, in my view, thrown away, given to the armaments manufacturers, mostly in the United States, but some in Canada, in order to create more wars and kill people.
It also seems to me that it doesn't go towards all the people dying of drug overdoses, more of them dying than soldiers in foreign conflicts. Anyway, I think the media is a bit problematic. I mean, nowhere do I see them talking about NATO as being a bad thing that I've in mainstream media. What have you learned about circumventing the media, these media narratives in 2024?
I think that that the only way that we are going to get around the fact that the media has basically censored the peace movement in Canada is to use social media and alternate media, such as you're providing us with here today, Michael. Thank you very much. I thank Global Research very much as well. It also means that we have to get out among people and have rallies and demonstrations. We are planning to have the rallies next weekend across Canada in several cities. And in many cities as well, our branches are having what we call watch parties of the live stream from the Counter Summit, because it will be live streamed for free. And the place where you can get that free live stream, it's very simple. It's tinyurl.com/StopNATO-Zoom. I repeat that?
Yeah.
Okay. tinyurl.com/StopNATO-Zoom.
Okay. Ken, thank you very much for coming on the show. And we'll look forward to the event as it's streamed live, for sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you for having me.
For sure. It's always great to have you on the show, Ken.
My pleasure.
Ken Stone he's the treasurer of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and organizing with the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network.
That's it for our show. Join us next week for more on the Freedom Convoy. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.